Thank you very much, Patrick. I hope I can maybe live up to that. I'm not sure whether I can or not. But anyway, Parsifal, like all of Wagner's dramas, I think is much to tell us at the intersection of authorial intention and latent content, what is revealed and what is repressed. Dreams were certainly of great importance to Wagner, perhaps most famously in his claim that the prelude to Das Rheingold had come to him in a kind of somnambulistic state, the feeling of being immersed in rapidly flowing water, and indeed in the dramatic material of a number of his works. Die Meistersinger von Nürnberg is explicitly concerned with the formation of an artwork that's initially revealed in a dream world. That offers an interesting way to consider, I think, stagings of his works too, and their claims to fidelity or otherwise at a textual or allegedly deeper level. I'll consider the claim of the work itself, probably better put inverted commas around that, to stand apart from the operatic repertoire as a Bühnenweihfestspiel, stage festival consecration play, to be confined to Wagner's artistic temple at Bayreuth. However, my principal focus will be upon those two particular productions Patrick mentioned, those of Stefan Herrheim, which ran Bayreuth from 2008 to 12, and a new one from Dmitry Chernyakov, first seen in Berlin in 2015. A broader, implicit question to which we might like to return in discussion more explicitly would be, how do directors and performers navigate the historical, social, cultural, psychological distances and conflicts between Wagner's intentions, his ability and inability to fulfill and perhaps even to transcend those intentions, and the needs of contemporary theatres and audiences? What is gained and what is lost? What again is revealed and what is repressed? Herrheim's production opens with Parsifal at the time of its first Bayreuth staging in 1882. It proceeds to tell a history that leads to somewhere approaching the present day, even turning a mirror upon the audience at one point, a moment with considerably greater theatrical power than a mere retelling might suggest. Sounds a bit of a cliche, but actually, at that point in the drama, it really makes its own point. The audience then is not simply accused, deservedly or otherwise, it's also reminded that it belongs to a drama that remains unfinished, whatever Wagner's Hegelian aspirations towards totality, and that it, the audience, interprets, shapes, perhaps even writes the history suggested. Far then from having reached a Fukuyama-like end of history, and how hollow such claims have seemed since 1989, but certainly in the past week alone, we might all have become historians, or indeed analysts for that matter, a challenge already to the gathered congregation of Bayreuth orthodoxy, whether that be Wagner's own or not. That position stands superficially close, perhaps, to postmodernism. Yet given the persistence we have of the work concept, in a very strong sense, I think, remains more grounded in some form of object, some form of reality, than critics of history, the musical work, and the connections between them might wish. Wagner, though he sometimes came close to positing what seems to me rather false immediacy of audience response, was no proponent of art as non-reflective, non-reflexive entertainment, purveyor of the diversions opponents of interpretive stage direction more often than not wish to see enacted. Our theatrical public, he complained in opera and drama, has no need for the artwork. It desires diversion from the stage, well-crafted details, rather than the necessity of artistic unity. The enemy here was miniaturism, the inability to construct a greater whole, which can be extended, and in his essay on conducting, lavishly praised by conductors from Furtwängler to Boulez, most certainly was. An attempt, even if it's a forlorn attempt, to achieve some form of unity, of vision, remained his modernistic goal. Let's then keep our sights upon Herrheim's Parsifal, or rather, return our sights to them. That matter of conducting, I think, is not irrelevant here, but whereas some matters of individual vocal performance may ultimately prove to be of ephemeral interest when we're looking at the broader scope of reception. The question of coherence between music and drama, itself, of course, a very false antithesis, is avowedly not. Under the musical leadership of Daniele Gatti, the work strained under Herrheim towards that unity which in some sense it must present. Gatti's reading proved controversial. Indeed, some writers dismissed it out of hand. One writer, for example, in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, addressing the first revival in 2009, dubbed the conducting uninspired with extremely unctuous tempi, though in not untypical journalistic fashion, neglected to explain what he meant by those terms. In that respect, the reviewer concluded, there was still a need for redemption. That, however, was certainly not Herrheim's understanding. In a fascinating interview, he averred that, whilst he admitted to retaining some reservations concerning some choices of tempi, considered quite how unusual it is actually for a stage director even to think about such matters, the experience of working together had been fruitful for both of them and had made the collaboration far more than the sum of its parts. In this interview, he said, when I heard him, that's Gatti, conducting his first Parsifal in Rome in concert performances, I was somewhat surprised and startled. He was even slower than Toscanini. The first act alone lasted for well over 2 hours. Daniele was equally suspicious of my ideas, and for a while I was afraid that our different approaches wouldn't be productive and that the collaboration wouldn't work. But during the rehearsals in Bayreuth, we immediately began to communicate. Daniele saw that I felt the musical gestures totally intuitively. It's worth actually mentioning here that Herrheim, not uniquely by any means, but a relatively unusually stage director, actually was a professional musician himself, cellist, and that my direction corresponded with his interpretation of the score. And during the rehearsal process, I learned to understand his tempo choices and musical perspectives much better. Our collaboration turned out to be very productive, creative, and we have great respect for each other. Now, this issue of staging the prelude to the first act, which actually was a bit of a bone of contention to start with, Gatti was very suspicious of that, was resolved more amicably, more fruitfully than it would be a little later with Daniel Barenboim in Lohengrin. So there was a big public falling out between director and conductor, conducted largely, well, at least partly in the newspapers, and there was a very, very false reconciliation I saw at the premiere where Barenboim tried to ruffle Herrheim's hair and there was a sense of turning away and they've never spoken since. But anyway, so at least, rather good theatre in itself, I mean, it might be good for curtain calls in general, but Herrheim made the excellent point in the interview cited above, that I just mentioned there, that would suggest that once the curtain rose, the audience need no longer concern itself with the music. That seems to be the way some people experience it. I mean, you have this moment where you have a few moments with the overture prelude where this is the music. And he's worried that actually after that, people think it's then about the stage. Continuing, I'm not saying that in principle the prelude should always be staged, but if you have good reasons to portray the music in the prelude, it's just the way that it's done that you can argue against. Gatti acknowledged this and was excited about the symbiosis the staging entered into with the music. Crucially, that symbiosis enabled, even provoked, the emergence of an idea of the score as redeemer, rather against that Frankfurter Allgemeine criticism I mentioned above. Was subtle, I think, this idea, rather than thrust in one's face, unlike the provocative second act Nazi imagery, which I'll address a little later. Yet for that reason, and it might well take more than one encounter fully to appreciate this, Herrheim's candidate for an answer to Wagner's celebrated riddle of redemption to the Redeemer, that is, the music, in all its contradiction, as well as in its emotional and psychological immediacy, emerged all the more convincingly. Again, that was a possibility rather than a definitive solution, but I think successful dramas often, at least, like successful performances,
tend to trade in possibilities rather than solutions. Otherwise, they'd be treatises. The tale of German history, of Parsifal as a work developing through that history, could thereby be seen and heard as requiring and receiving some form of transcendental or at least beneficial intervention. Not so much the grace Wagner speaks of in Parsifal, but something more imminent, arising from within, the attempted negation of the litany of negative dialectics to which history and work have been subjected. There was then no false mediated unity in which to rejoice or rather to wallow. Ritual was in Parsifal and through Parsifal, dynamically, dialectically challenged from within as well as from without. And I think actually that's the very stuff of Wagner's drama. For Parsifal, I think, was all intended to be and has remained different. Wagner's various attempts to avoid the pejorative, to him, opera as a description of his later works may nowadays elicit as much scepticism as blind adoration, though certainly simply calling Tristram and Isolde Handlung, drama or action, he captured a quality of that singular work. I mean, you might say in another way, he did quite the opposite. I mean, what there's very little of is action in one sense. However, I think it would take a Wagnerian of extreme, unhealthy devotion not to raise at least a hint of a smile at the cumbersome Bühnenweihfestspiel. But what that term might mean, I think, has brought all manner of consequences for the work's reception, even indeed given the determination of Cosima and other Bayreuth loyalists that it should remain confined to the stage it allegedly consecrated, for the possibility of staging it at all. The surrounding aura of sanctity may seem to many repellent. For example, Stravinsky called it an unseemly and sacrilegious conception of art as religion and the theatre as a temple, or ridiculous. Debussy, albeit continuing to honour the score alone, as one of the loveliest monuments ever raised to the serene glory of music, or both, as in Nietzsche's case. Moreover, they claim that Parsifal is in any straightforward sense a Christian work, as opposed to a work that treats with Christianity, I think would find very few takers today. Even if the end of the first act were an invitation to receive Holy Communion, the Grail Knight's words, partake of the bread, valiantly transform it into corporeal strength and power, suggest a church or a theology whose heterodoxy extended between the merely Gnostic. That said, this tale of a pure fool, so ignorant that he knows neither whence he has come, nor even his name, who through the offices of divine grace, rather than by his own deeds, enlightened through compassion, rejuvenates a dying community, remains quite different from the operatic essays of any of Wagner's contemporaries and many of his successors. Parsifal resists assimilation to the opera house. It's out of place among champagne, canapes, and diva worshippers. Wagner wrote to Ludwig II, in fact, that he wished to protect it from what he called a common operatic career. And Boulez, a highly distinguished interpreter and critic as well, his compositional successor, understood this very well when he approvingly wrote of Wagner loathing a system in which opera houses are like cafes where you can hear waiters calling out their orders, one Carmen and one Valkyra and one Rigoletto. I think no prizes for guessing which of the three works was more congenial to him. Wagner's works, then, declare their incompatibility with existing theatrical conventions and norms, even today, arguably more so today. And of those works, I think Parsifal remains the ultimate. The signal strength of Perheim's production is that it engages with these problems, with the fraught associations, both with Bayreuth, which for better and for worse is also quite different from anywhere else. Here we see Wagner's own Villa Wahnfried on stage, and this is where it starts in the first act, and with broader historical themes too. Associations the work has gathered from at least the time of its premiere in 1882. It's so intensely dialectical and multi-layered was Herrheim's direction that he managed somehow, I think, successfully to tread a tightrope between presentation of his guiding concept, or concept in German, that is, the history of Parsifal as a work, and the world in which it's developed from the time of its first performance, and recounting of the imminent story of Parsifal. I mean, actually, I've never seen a staging that is so loyal to many of Wagner's own stage directions. The two stories, while not so much in parallel as with mutual influence, yet without inflicting harm upon each other, and with no sense of contrivance. In the first act, we therefore witness the early days of post-Wagner Wahnfried, the sickly, incestuous goings-on of an impeccably old bourgeois family and its nursery. Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks comes to mind, in the era of an oft-present imperial eagle. As Christianity entered an especially peculiar phase, dreams and childhood come to the fore, likewise the psychopathology of religious experience, which both Nietzsche and Thomas Mann saw as fundamental to the work. A priest, incense, Nietzsche's accusation of Wagner sinking to his knees before the cross re-examined, and most shockingly, perhaps, circumcision of the infant, who may or may not be a young Parsifal, offer almost as much food for thought as Wagner's own inversion, echoing the philosophy of Feuerbach, of the elements of Holy Communion itself. The violence of the deed could hardly have been more topical when I saw it in 2012, just at the time of the legal controversy over infant genital mutilation in Germany. And yet it also, I think, pointed to something broader, older, deep-seated, and of course very much part of the work's reception history, the question of whether anti-Semitism might actually be being expressed in Wagner's dramas. And notably, it doesn't propose answers. And Forthaus, at any rate, perhaps seemed far more central than he often does to the drama. His cry of pain jolted us from complacent knowledge of the work, also pointing forward, or backward, to Kundry's scream of laughter at Christ, who, whatever Wagner might have hoped, must also have undergone the procedure on the road to Calvary. The second act, I'm sorry this is a bit smaller, but I'm not very good with putting these on the things, and that was as good as I could do. The second act, anyway, opens in a field hospital. For once, and this is typical of Herrheim's attention to Wagner's detail, we actually see the renegade knights, Sir Ferus and all. Klingsorb, in a sense, appears as a cabaret master of ceremonies. We behold Weimar Germany, our Moorish castle's owner suggestive in white tie and fishnet stockings. The delicious representation of the flower maidens as orderlies and flappers, I mean, they're not exactly what they are, gains dramatic attention, as well as firmly placing us in the interwar period. I say firmly, but actually as the act progressive, time goes on as well. And yet, a reminder that various levels of interpretation are anything but distinct is offered by a greater keenness of manipulation when it comes to Kundry's acts, above all, what she tells Parsifal. She is in turn, of course, being manipulated by Klingsor, yet perhaps so many of us are understandably now influenced by feminist readings that we feel uncomplicatedly sympathetic. It's salutary, I think, to be reminded, whatever we then think of this, that this rose of hell, the rose very much part of Herrheim's imagery, new video technology included, showing rose blooming, has, despite her plight, agency of her own. I think that's much more probably feminist, it seems to me, than to consider her purely as victim. And the similarity of costume between her and Klingsor, both in Weimar cross-dressing travesty, reinforced the need both have for each other, in the sense of Hegelian master-slave dialectic re-examined. Wagner's artwork, then, is permitting of answers, or better, further questions, which he may or may not have been able to conceive himself. The final scene of the second act is electric, the coming of Bayreuth's and Germany's darkest years truly shocking. And I wish I had a picture to show you of this. It's quite notable, actually, that the large number of pictures the Bayreuth press office sent out to people, there was no picture of this. They were quite scared by it, I think. In any case, the phrase coup de théâtre might have been invented for this advent of the Third Reich, signalled by the Weimar Castle's destruction, the arrival of stormtroopers, a brown-shirted tomorrow belonging to him, little boy, and the unfurling of swastikas. Overdue, yet nevertheless courageous, the festival seemed at last ready to begin to come to terms with its histories. Its history. Judging by the disgruntled noises from some members of the audience, it remained an absolute necessity, too. Then the final act opened in the garden of a bombed Warnfried. Parsifal's coming and Good Friday offered the possibility... Sorry, I've gone on a bit, but we'll come to that in a minute. Parsifal's coming and Good Friday offer the possibility, illusory perhaps, of rejuvenation. In a tribute to the Bayreuth Tannhäuser of Gertz Friedrich, with whom Herheim studied, a procession of the starved post-war population crossed the stage, victims of what has gone before, in a sense, the mendacious ideology of the Wirtschaftswunder, the so-called post-war economic press German mirror, and its culture industry. The point of ultimate hope seemed to come when a star briefly appeared in the sky, wonderfully touching in a way, yet what does it signify? And it seemed also to me, actually, yesterday, to be looking back to Zieberberg's Parsifal. That a false messiah's advent, a simple childlike pleasure, certainly rang truer than the gaudy coloured lights signalling Parsifal's descent into the realm of the guru. Another brave coup de théâtre, and I think Herheim never forgets that Parsifal, amongst other things, is theatre, came with a projection during the transformation music. A request was displayed from the young Wagner brothers Wieland and Wolfgang at the 1951 reopening of Bayreuth, or opening of new Bayreuth, according to taste, that political discussion be banished from the Green Hill. An image of Wagner was bricked up behind Parsifal's childhood wall, the composer remaining too hot to handle. Might we also recall that Warnfried wall built by Wolfgang, on whose other side Winifred remained until her death, a standing, tenacious reminder that politics could not be so easily banished. If anything, politics stood still more starkly at the heart of the final scene, which you see here. And Fortis's trial, in every sense, took us from post-war Nuremberg to the present-day Bundestag. The problematical nature of charismatic leadership here for all to see. Parsifal, interestingly, was not one of the trio seen at the close, presumably hastening us to an uncertain future. Instead, we found ourselves in the hands of Gournemanz, Kundry, she does not inspire, and a young boy. Or is that young boy Parsifal? And has the whole drama been a dream, or rather the ultimate nightmare? Certainly no solace to be had from the bickering politicians of the Bundestag, the flag of the Federal Republic draping Titual's coffin, yet Parsifal here seems to have offered at best a dead end, a touch of snake oil, perhaps a modern politician. And Fortus, like Siegfried, seems to have gained in dignity to view there. Is it nihilism, as Nietzsche would doubtless have had it, or Wagner's lifelong anarchism? Again, these are questions, no answers. I was going to say a little about The Mirror, but I think I'd better turn to Chernyakov's Berlin production, which I saw both at its 2015 premiere and again this year on Good Friday. The outer acts, in their different yet similar ways, suggest a Russian thinker approaching Wagner. Like Herheim, and indeed many of the most interesting contemporary opera directors, I said, Chernyakov seems more concerned to open up possibilities than to present definitive verdicts. Modern, relatively indistinct dress doesn't distract, but suggests sameness, and indeed an ossified dedication to something that no longer pertains. Perhaps a lesson there for traditional staging fetishists, among others. Kinder machen Neues, as Wagner himself is reported to have exclaimed, children, let's do it differently next time, following his own Bayreuth staging of The Ring, with which he was deeply dissatisfied. Crucially, I think, however, very interestingly, a very important aspect of this production is that Chernyakov doesn't disregard religion as religion. It's not simply a proxy for political, aesthetic, other concerns. As in Wagner's work itself, the relationship's complex, indeed provocative. There's here, then, what may have been a once Christian theology gone wrong, as Wagner's conception of Monsalva demands. Just as in the second act of Götterdämmerung, when increasingly desperate pleas are made to gods who've already departed the stage, so in Parsifal, the crowd continues to believe and to act out of desperation, out of their belief, or at least to act as if it's still believed. Men act to protect a ritual, and of course, as Ava reminded us, they are men, a ritual which has long lost its justification, if ever it had one. A world of Russian holy men, perhaps allied to the anti-Wagnerian challenges of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, reacts with that of Wagner's still-live contest between Feuerbach and Schopenhauer. These are old believers, perhaps even old believers in the Russian sense, but actually, you know, this tableau here puts one in mind of Goya or Mussorgsky's Kovanshina. Will the new rule, political or monastic, of Parsifal bring more of the same? Gunmont's shocking stabbing in the back of Kundry at the end seems effortlessly to have transferred his loyalty to the new regime, although at what cost has he been concealing whatever he has done in the past? Or will that new rule bring something different? We don't know, nor do they. Who or what, if anything, has been redeemed? Again, we don't know. What we do know is that Gornemanns has swiftly put paid to the purely human, as the younger Feuerbachian Wagner would have put it, rekindling of sexual relations between Kundry, or woman, and Amfortas, or Christ, or at least Jesus of Nazareth. There are certainly clues. Again, Amfortas is identified more with Christ on stage than I can previously recall. He's carried by the knights so as to make him, however unhappily and unwillingly, a visual, if perhaps not spiritual, reincarnation. More disturbingly still, we see during the final scene of the first act a reenactment not only of Amfortas' wounding, but also of some form of transubstantiation, or perhaps mere vampirism, of his own blood. The sustenance drawn may well be nothing, as a negative reading of Feuerbach there, or it may even be primarily vengeful. There's no doubt, however, that this sick community requires it, and most intriguingly of all, it's commanded by Tichel, whom we see walk on stage and enter his coffin. He's clearly running the whole show. He's the director on stage. Tichel's ritualistic restaging, or rather staging, of his own death in the first act, and re-emergence from the coffin once it is all over, stand at the very heart of the drama. He's a sinister, charismatic dictator, the cult leader we all know and fear. Moreover, his sadism in insisting, for whatever reasons, that his son Amfortas go through what he must time and time again, chills to the bone. Is Tichel a fraud or a thaumaturge? We don't know. The knights are desperate, though, for him to touch them. He certainly appears to be pulling the theological strings of a cult that has become nasty indeed. The sameness of the first act, the scene doesn't shift until the transformation music, and indeed the production here burns as slowly and yet as brightly as the work, receives its response in what to begin with seems the entirely unconnected action of the second. Here, Chelyakov offers a brave, challenging exploration of sexuality, above all of those paedophiliac tendencies our society would desperately wish away as aberration, as the misdeeds of individual monsters. Klingsor here, the very image of a tabloid newspaper paedophile monster, and you can see the sort of Sun headline beneath it there, has built a home with his daughters, the flower maidens. Some are young, some are older, some are older women dressed up as, in inverted commas, pretty girls. Such is clearly what has proved the undoing of Monsalva's knights. He clearly repels Kundry, not least when he paws her, but she of course remains in his power, perhaps because he's put himself beyond the moral pale, very Nietzschean, or perhaps we might think again of Crime and Punishment. When in Klingsor's power, she's certainly willing to learn from his example, or from what it might suggest. Her kissing him already suggests an inconvenient truth concerning the complexity of abuse. Wagner's Path of Realization, which I'm tempted, albeit I think with great trepidation in this museum and to this audience, to call psychoanalytical, is given shocking realization in Kundry's Education of Parsifal, partly visualized in the staging of his memories. Andreas Schager, whom you see there as Parsifal, cemented his reputation, for me at least, as the finest Helden tenor alive, indeed the finest I've heard in the flesh. Moreover, his movements on stage offered a well-nigh perfect portrayal of the awkwardness of an adolescent discovering his sexuality. His reluctance to show himself, hiding himself under the hood, pulled down by Hertz, Elida, and Kundry alike, finds its counterpart in his persistent change in clothes, seemingly a desire to be clean that can never be fulfilled. This Parsifal and his mother, Hertz, Elida, were certainly close, almost certainly too close. She's furious when she sees his adolescent first exploration with a girl next door, or perhaps even his sister, it's not quite clear. The emotional fallout kills her, just as Kundry tells him, and does. Kundry, however, attempts to play upon those complex feelings, to reignite them, reintroducing him to the miniature rocking horse with which once, under the spell of his mother, he had played. Quite what happens remains unclear, since the moment of the kiss, is it perhaps more than that, takes place very unusually off stage. The transformation it effects when undressed, Parsifal followed by Kundry runs back onto the stage, is however never in doubt. The would-be sign of the cross in this dark world is Parsifal's piercing of Klingsor with his spear. A crucial feature of the production that has tied both acts together is the circular seating and action of the respective crowds, knights and flower maidens. Sickness pervades both. They may well be more closely connected. The third act, then, continues the work of drawing the two get together, though again, suggestively, rather than didactically. Ritual to drama, to ritual, in that indispensable German, aufgehoben's, overcome but preserved, by drama. But was it the wrong drama? When in the third act, Amfortas opens his father's tomb and has his body fall to the ground, is that simply revenge for the inhuman treatment, the abuse, our Christ-like, yet ultimately not so very Christ-like, victim has suffered? Or is it also perhaps a hint at the death of God, Chichul being his father? Nietzsche, as well as those Russian writers, seems hinted at, or at least available. Nihilism, or theological rescue mission. As when one reads Nietzsche, perspectivism demands and yet obscures the answer. One signal strength, or say just in conclusion, of both productions, I think, is their willingness to deal with that particularity of the work I mentioned earlier, its insistence upon its difference, its opposition to general operatic culture, as well as the myriad of connections, correspondences, and so forth, some intrinsic, some developed along the way of the work in the world since its premiere in 1882. I've barely been able to scratch the surface here. But what David J. Levin analysed as the operatic conservatives, in this case he was particularly talking about James Levine at the Met, dread of the hectic stage of discursive overload, has turned out, I think, in both these cases, actually to harness such overloads of fidelity, in a sense all manner of opera goers could and eventually did appreciate. That's certainly, I think, also highly relevant to the Zieberberg film some of us watched yesterday. We perform, then, rather than reenact. Similarly, we study as well as we perform, so that we think rather than wallow. History, musical or otherwise, is something we write as well as make, something we think. We might perhaps say the same about dreams as well, Wagner's and our own. Herrheim's and Chernyakov's dramaturgies have enabled Wagner's music, I think, perhaps still more so than his words, to emerge as redeemer, not in some discredited, romantic sense of absolute music with all the connotations that has acquired, but in a critical sense, suited to our own time and to its concerns. Thank you.
very much indeed, Mark. That was absolutely, absolutely wonderful. Wonderful evocation of two fascinating productions that, alas, I've never seen, but would certainly have loved to do. We have just a few minutes for Mark. Would you like to sit there? And
yes,
Ava, would you like to come up and sit here? Because I'm sure that many of you maybe kind of have a lot of questions that you'd like to ask. Could you start with Barry at the back? Barry Millington.
Two absolutely brilliant papers. Thank you very much, both of you. And just so much that could be said, and I've been scribbling down notes while listening to them. But perhaps I could just start, Ava, by addressing some of your points. As I say, an absolutely wonderful paper, but a devastating critique of Wagner and pretty much everything he stands for, I think. And so I feel obliged almost to just maybe put one or two points that perhaps we might like to discuss and see him in a different light. First of all, could I just recall something that Tom Artin, a point made in his first paper, about the Grail being the symbol of female sexuality. So, of course, what we're seeing is the integration of the male and the female in terms of the sphere and the Grail coming together. So perhaps, although, as you rightly say, and I have to admit that a large part of your avowedly feminist critique of the work, I'm very sympathetic to, and I understand exactly where you're coming from. But I do think that perhaps it's important to remember some of these other aspects. Also, Parsifal, is it really female sexuality that is demonized? Is it really women's desire, as you put it? Or is it sexuality in general? Because don't forget that Fortas also gets a good deal of the blame. I think it is sexuality per se. And we could perhaps look at it as not being about chastity, about denial of sexuality, but maybe this is symbolic of something wider, perhaps some sort of acceptance of moral responsibility, some coming to terms with sexuality. You say that in Parsifal, woman is pushed into a non-existent role, but it's not the male community that is apparently represented as superior. Of course, it's far from ideal. Nobody's going to defend that community, least of all Wagner, I think, and Mark has shown us representations that make that quite clear. Just two more very small points, and I'll let you blow me out of the water. You quite rightly say, I think, that what we're seeing is Kundry unsettling this patriarchal order. I think that is probably key to it. Because what it seems to me is happening here is that Wagner is grappling with these problems of sexuality, with his eroticism. And I do agree with you here about this being, in a sense, all his life's work is about grappling with problems of eroticism. And that's where we come to these very interesting productions that Mark has been talking about. Which we can see in Freudian terms, if you like, of what is revealed, what is repressed. And maybe it's the role of directors such as Chernyakov and Herrheim and indeed Zuberberg, for those of us who saw the film yesterday, maybe it's their role to salvage from Parsifal elements that could be seen in a more positive light.
I don't know what to say. So many questions. I can't go into them. I think I'll give it back to the public, to the audience to discuss. I think my paper was a bit of a provocation. I agree to that. I was thinking, what can I do with lots of people who are psychologists and psychoanalysts? I know nothing about this or hardly anything. I would just look at his life and try to translate it into the work I see. And I agree with what most of what you say. I mean, you say the grail could be female sexuality, something one is not allowed to touch or which is holy. I mean, it goes parallel to what I was saying about the asceticism and the chastity. I'll pass it on to you.
I think likewise I agree and certainly very much with what Barry says about that being part of what a director's... So that's very much part of what a director's job is, actually, to teach things. I mean, Helheim does a very good job of dealing with almost everything that seems to be in there. But many, many directors are more single-minded, and I think, you know, there's room for either approach. I mean, not everything has to deal with everything every time, but certainly at certain times of a work's history, some things are more problematical than others, and just evading certain issues seems to me more problematical in that sense than others. And the stage is one area where one can actually deal with these issues. I don't think it should just be when we're sitting around talking about it. We want to see these things teased out on stage, dramatised, you know, a bit of blood on the floor, really.
It seems to me very, very interesting and rather lamentable that new Bayreuth, as it were, has apparently seeks really to censorship Herheim's production, because there was to have been a DVD of it, I believe, which they've not allowed, and obviously the press office, this goes back at Bayreuth for many years, has been told absolutely not to release any of the pictures of that end of the second act. That seems to me to be extremely lamentable. Would anybody like to ask? We need some psychoanalytic input into this.
Now, I'm a Jungian analyst, so possibly coming in at a different angle, but just from my own therapeutic work as well, what really strikes me about the figure of Kundry is, firstly, a very general point, and Jung is very good at big historical sweeps, which is she seems to me to be a sort of disfigured form of the feminine, and it always feels to me as if millennia of patriarchy have made her into what she is, so I find her an incredibly poignant figure. And also, I find Wagner's depiction of her both in music and dramatically to be a really painful description of mental disorder. I see her as a woman who is disordered and disturbed, and but, you know, those chromatic lines and the wildness of her. If one's had to spend time observing in a hospital, for instance. You know, and I find that quite heartrending. I wonder whether you would like to comment on that.
Yes, of course she is heartrending, because she is forced by Klingsor to do all these things which she doesn't want to do. And in the first act, actually, she's quite friendly, trying to help with getting these barns from other countries. The way she's treated is awful. She's treated as a second-rate person and has no question whatsoever. The fact that she has to... Well, I mean, we can say Wagner has pity for her. This is a matter of discussion. What I think is that those artists get the most famous who leave the most room for interpretation. We can really interpret for hours and months on end and come to no final conclusion.
I'll just make a small interpolation, because it seems to me the great interest of her is exactly this ambivalence, this two-sidedness of her, because of course she's presented in many ways as being a wicked lady seducing people, but also she's presented, I think, by Wagner as a good servant of the community of the Grail, doing good. So she does both good and evil, it seems to me. Shall we pass that to Sebastian?
Thank you. I hope my English is good enough for the discussion. Thank you for your paper. First of all, I want to say something about the Freudian theory of sexuality, because we have heard castration is equal to femininity, and indeed it is, but only in a certain stage of sexual development, which is the phallic stage, which a little boy has, and not the genital sexuality. So if we make our interpretations, we should differentiate these two levels of sexual development. So this is one general point of the discussion we have today. And the other question I wanted to put to you, I really appreciated your paper, and it's very near to the facts of life of Wagner. My question goes to a kind of a paradox. Isn't it very paradoxical that Wagner put Kundry in this awful position, and at the same time is so empathetic to her? He follows, and this is, to me, is the central of the drama, not Pascal. He follows her into her pain.
Yes.
He dozed along with her in her feeling of pain and despair from the awful position she has been put in.
Yes, but we know that he's the way he characterizes all these characters. Take for instance Mimo, who suffers so much. He can show much empathy with negative characters too. And the fact that this Grail is victorious in the end, and the woman, it disappears, and we have only men on the stage, I find that really most irritating, as his last message to the world.
Yes.
And the spirituality belonging to men, I mean, that's most irritating.
Yes. I do just want to, it's a very small follow-up, and one has to remember that Kundry has had endless lives, hasn't she, in the story? And she's suffered in those lives, and for her, rest is something she craves. Mm. And so I'm not sure he's writing her off. I think he may be giving her peace.
Okay.
We'll take one more question, because then we really do have to break. Steve,
it's just a word about psychoanalysis. Mm. That's what you were underlining. In that, Kundry. You were speaking, Ava, about Wagner's hatred of his dependence on women,
yes.
And a lot of this is explored. That's through psychoanalysis, British object relations, for example. But going back to Freud's original theories weren't necessarily about the infant's fantasies of the primal scene, of male child of women, but it was originally the seduction theory, that in the earliest days of nurture, of care, there was a seduction going on, that sexuality is involved. And it was the French psychoanalyst, the post-Lacanian analyst, Jean Laplanche, who tried to retrieve this. So that, in fact, what you've got in Act Two is a sort of very sort of modern, post-Freudian view, on one reading of it, of the seduction theory, that everything involved with the mother and the upbringing of the infant is also involved in seduction as well. Sexuality is there from the start. The breast is a sexual breast, and so that the infant, it's too much for the for the infant. It's too much for some of us throughout the rest of life. so we endlessly, without fantasies, endlessly end up interpreting and translating, or, as Laplanche put it, de-translating the messages that we have solidified in our own minds. And I think ideology sort of piggybacks that as well, you know, as we've seen, as again, as Mark has seen last week.
Can I just say, though,
quickly,
in relation to what you just said, of course it does denote how much power that the mother has too.
Yes.
Because she is the person who can introduce the child to the father or not, as the case may be. So, and it's interesting that in the second act there's something there about the kiss, that this is your first kiss of love.
Yes.
And whether she is able to relinquish that power. And of course, women have the power to give birth, don't they, and create in a different way.
I mean, there's one possible question, which is that for a child, in this moment that Stephen's talking about care of the child, the mother is beautiful. And I think that there is an issue about coming into sexuality where how is it that the woman becomes a fearsome beauty? How does that happen? And this is what is happening in both. So in other words, what happens when there's an innocent kind of sexuality in relation to the care of the child, but then something happens where it becomes sexualized in an adult way, and that becomes an area of fearfulness.
We must bear in mind that Freud lived after Wagner. Wagner had no ideas about these theories, and you are interpreting them on top of Wagner. And I think we should bear that in mind.
I think we really sadly do have to bring it to an end, because I think we'd all like to have some lunch. But I think I'd just like to plant one sort of concluding thought after thanking most warmly our two speakers. We've had a great session, as I'm sure you'll agree.